Do you have an idea for a podcast, but you don't know where to start? Maybe you're overwhelmed by all the tech or you're convinced nobody will actually listen to you. Well, I'm Shauna Game. After 9.5 years as a professional podcaster, at this show, Everyone's Talking Money, and 25 million downloads later, let me tell you the secret to a profitable podcast. It is building a solid foundation, your podcast roadmap before you launch. That's why I created the Podcaster Class, a fast-paced group cohort podcasting for profit 8-week style MBA program. The Podcaster Class is immersive, comprehensive, and insanely motivational. If you want to create a podcast, DIYing a launch is just not the way to go. In the Podcaster Class, you'll get the tools, tips, and strategies to create a podcast that resonates with listeners and one you can be proud of. Get this, 90% of podcasters never make it to episode 3. That's 2.8 million podcasters who just quit. So to be a top podcaster, you only need to publish 21 episodes, but you got to make them good. So in the Podcaster Class, I'm taking the mystery out of how to create, launch, and profit from your podcast so you can create a top 1% podcast just like this one. The May cohort is now open for enrollment. Classes start May 22nd. There are only 15 spots open. You are going to learn podcasting with me and 14 other amazing people. You can learn all the details at thepodcasterclass.com. Use code podcast when you sign up for $100 off. That's thepodcasterclass.com. When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I was paying for vacations all wrong. I was missing out on miles. I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? I don't know, maybe that fancy hotel upgrade that you have always been dreaming about. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
So I think index funds is arguably the greatest invention of the financial industry of the past half century. This is a really cheap, simple product that has saved millions of Americans hundreds of billions of dollars just directly. And indirectly, we're probably talking in the trillions. And that's why the only financial advice I ever feel comfortable giving to people is being a little bit lazy and choosing a handful of cheap, boring, low-cost, well-diversified index funds and forgetting about it until the day they retire.
You're listening to Millennial Money with award-winning money expert and serial entrepreneur, Shauna Come to Game, where we flip the script on the old-school approach to everything your parents never taught you about money. Each week, Shauna creates a safe space by talking with special guests from around the world about money wellness, entrepreneurship, traveling like a boss, and what makes millennials tick. Unique stories, trailblazing perspectives, tips, tricks, and everything there is to know about money. Find it all here as you uncover your money story and unlock the life you want to live. Pretty cool, right? Here's Shauna, money expert, Indiana Hoosier, and burger aficionado.
Welcome back to the show, my friend. I'm so excited to have you here for this. I'm going to use the word exciting twice for this very exciting episode. Before we jump in, I do have a favor to ask. If you could click the link in the show notes to head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. This is one of the best ways to continue to grow the show. And in that review for December, I want you to tell us the craziest thing that you've done to save money during the holiday season. I'm going to be hand-selecting a few of the reviews to share throughout the month. I'm going to be sending you a little special surprise as a thank you. So head on over to the link and leave us a 5-star review in Apple Podcasts. Okay, I want you to imagine this. A bunch of really smart people sitting around a table and deciding to invent a financial product that would democratize investing and save investors like you and me billions of dollars in fees. And thus, the index fund was invented. Probably the most popular way that most of us invest today. where our guest, Robin Wigglesworth, has written this phenomenal, very insightful book called Trillions: How a Band of Wall Street Renegades Invented the Index Fund and Changed Finance Forever. Whether you're a newbie to index funds or a seasoned pro, Robin's going to share with you the incredible power of index funds, what the heck they even are, and why he believes being a little bit lazy is the key to building wealth and financial success. You can sign me up for that for sure. I'm Shauna Compton-Game. This is Millennial Money, and I am over the moon to bring you this insightful and educational conversation. Here we go. Robin, I am so excited to have you on the podcast. This is going to be such an amazing conversation. So thank you so much for being here all the way from Norway.
Yes, no, thanks for having me on. I mean, it's dark and wet here, so it's nice to have something like this to look forward to.
Yeah, I mean, it's that season, right? And I know in Norway, it's even worse than where I am here in the US. You get many months of dark and wet, don't you?
Yes, I can deal with cold weather, the snow. I quite like winter. It's the 4 months of almost perfect darkness that really does get you down. So we just need to plow our way through it. But at least maybe, hopefully, we'll have a white Christmas to look forward to.
That is definitely something to look forward to. Well, we are going to have so much fun talking about your new book out. It's called Trillions: How a Band of Wall Street Renegades Invented the Index Fund and Changed Finance Forever. Now, I sat down to read your book yesterday, and wow, I mean, what an incredible story. So to start, I'd just love to know, what got you intrigued to even write this book and tell this story?
Well, so I used to live in New York, so I haven't always been sort of exiled to the cold fridge in Norway. And I was covering Wall Street for the Financial Times newspaper where I work at. And, you know, you have to be a little bit strategic about what you cover. So I wanted to do the big stuff, not the stock markets go up, stock markets go down, but the really big trends that were really affecting everything. And one of the biggest trends is the rise of index funds, passive investing, as it's sometimes almost pejoratively called. So I was covering this because it was, in many respects, almost on the QT, rewiring financial markets in front of my eyes and rippling through the entire investment industry and forcing big investment banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley to change how they did business. So I was covering this and I started digging into the history. And, you know, as a journalist, you sometimes have important stories that sadly aren't actually that interesting. Or you have really interesting stories that just aren't that actually that important. But sometimes, once in a blue moon, you have a story that is both absolutely vital, but also really fun and interesting. And the more I dug into the history of the people that invented index funds, the more I was kind of taken with this almost classic story of these kind of renegades inventing something really profoundly disruptive that was hated by their own industries and figuratively spat upon until finally they won and essentially kind of took over the world. So, yeah, that's the book I tried to write. And it was a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, it's such an interesting story with a lot of plot twists. And I think what's really interesting is you talk about how Wall Street really did not want this index fund revolution to come on, because this did really democratize investing and ultimately saved a lot of people a lot of money in fees that would have otherwise gone to Wall Street. For someone listening, though, who maybe, you know, is new to Wall Street and how things work, walk me through a little bit about what was the investing world like before this index fund kind of evolution?
Well, so it was just a radically different world, right? Obviously, it's the pre-internet days. But broadly speaking, when financial markets were first invented, you know, it was individual wealthy people that maybe invested through a stockbroker in the City of London or you know, on Wall Street. And there was physically a market outside on the street then. And then over time, this became more professional and people pooled money into collective investment funds. So there'd be investment trusts and the first mutual funds started emerging in the US 100 years ago. And for most of, you know, the subsequent century, it's all been about mutual funds. There have been other things invented like hedge funds and private equity, but mutual funds is, you know, there are $40 trillion globally in mutual funds. It's a phenomenal invention.
Wow.
But, you know, I don't want to be too mean to against people that work in finance, because most of the people there are incredibly upright, hardworking, smart, brilliant men and women. But I don't think I'm speaking out of turn by saying that most industries are keen on stuff that ensures they get paid well rather than how you get paid well. Most electricians,
that would be fair.
Yeah, exactly. Most electricians don't want to charge you the lowest possible price, right? So investment funds were always quite expensive. At the same time, in the 50s and 60s, especially, and by the 70s, this was well known in academia, people realized that even the professional fund managers actually did a really bad job. Now, some of this is just the simple maths that for everybody who buys or sells a stock, somebody's on the other side of that trade. And over an entire year, you know, everybody who has done worse than the market, somebody has to do better and vice versa. So if you're paying these people a lot of money, on average, the average investor is going to do less than the market. But people still kind of thought that, well, I can pick the best fund managers, the smartest people, the people that can do really well over a 10-year, 20-year period. But in reality, as the computer era dawned and people for the first time had concrete actual data written on like magnetic spools back then, they could see that the average fund manager didn't just do a little bit worse than the market. They did way worse than the market. Over a 10-year period, the vast majority of professional fund managers who, remember, you know, are smart, hardworking people, cannot beat the market. So that was the impetus between some heretics thinking that, well, if we can't beat the market, how about we just join the market and create a fund that literally does nothing but track an entire index, stock market index, like the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the FTSE, as cheaply as humanly possible. And that's what they did.
It's incredible. Yeah. I want to dive a bit into this motley crew of nerds, really smart people who got together and kind of came up with this idea. Tell me a little bit about who they are and how this idea really originated for them.
Well, I think the idea is originated in academia. I mean, it's quite often to dismiss, you know, what academics do is of ivory tower pontificating. But I really think there were just a handful of economists, you know, almost all of them went on to win Nobel Prizes for their work on things like this, that first, you know, mathematically showed, you know, that the stock market was actually a pretty good bet as a whole, that you could buy the market portfolio, as a guy called Bill Sharp said, and that would probably be the optimal trade-off between the risk of your investments and the return of your investments. And then somebody like Gene Farmer also came out with a fully fledged theory for why this was. Why were active managers, professional managers, doing such a miserable job on average? And he called it the efficient markets theory. That, you know, over time, you know, the market constantly bakes in all new relevant and sometimes, frankly, irrelevant information all the time. So the market might be wrong from time to time, but it's almost impossible to know ahead of time why that is. So those were the academics that inspired like the first batch of pioneers. And there were essentially, you know, three men, because it was all men in finance back in those days, working at second, third tier financial institutions far away from Wall Street. And I don't think that was a coincidence that they weren't working at sort of pedigreed big institutions at the time. So I think most institutions hate disrupting themselves, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, they were essentially, yeah, they're the renegades, the motley crew that I talk a lot about. But there was a guy called John Mac McQuown, a former farmhand from Illinois, first guy in his family to go to college. He worked at Wells Fargo when Wells Fargo was a tiny regional bank in San Francisco. There's a guy called Rex Sinkfield at American National Bank of Chicago. It wasn't even the biggest bank in Chicago at the time. And a kind of a zany, gregarious, outgoing guy called Dean LeBaron, who worked at a startup that he started outside Boston called Battery March. And I think they were the people that had some, the mix of both the brains, but quite possibly also the contrarian streak needed to do something that was at best seen as lazy by everybody else in the industry. And it were something that would, you know, ruin everybody's jobs, right?
Right. It sounds like, I mean, it's just, it's crazy to think about how really smart people got together and just decided, you know, we're just gonna change things, and how it hadn't been changed prior, I think is just a really interesting story. And then you write, like, the growth of mutual funds, I believe somewhere around $16 trillion, I think, by the end of 2020. The growth, just such a fast growth. Like, why do you think index funds grew so fast? Is it just because finally individual investors were able to invest in something that, you know, ultimately saved them time and money?
Yeah, I mean, it's the convenience and the cost. So, I mean, it took a long time. This was the first index fund, the very, very, very first index fund, sprung out in 1971. It managed the money for Samsonite's pension plan. And there were lots of pension plans that adopted this because they could see the numbers, the data. But for ordinary investors, this took a long time. This took decades to sink in. And it took people like Jack Bogle and Vanguard, the company he founded, to really sort of hammer this point home that, you know, even if you believe that there are active managers that can sustainably beat the market, usually they're so expensive that the vast majority of people are better off in index funds. And it's really only in the last 20 years this has taken off completely. So I think it took something like 30 years for the first $1 trillion in index funds. And since then, yes, we're now at $17 trillion. So those are index mutual funds and exchange traded funds, which is sort of a index fund 2.0 that trade on a stock exchange, just like any share, really. And it's just so titanically big, right? It's bigger, growing faster than pretty much any other corner of the financial industry. And I think the reason why some people, you know, are paying more attention to this, why I'm paying more attention to it, is that, you know, if this growth rate continues, they're kind of going to gobble up big chunks from the entire US or global stock market and, you know, have a lot of power eventually.
Yeah. And then what can we do with that power?
Well, we can, as investors, do quite a lot. I mean, the benefits of indexing are just enormous. I mean, I've seen one study that just looked at American investors in very traditional equity funds and calculated that over the past 25 years, they've saved directly $350 billion plus dollars in fees over those 25 years. That's money that is going to go straight into our pocket. But even that understates how much money we've all saved, because index funds is a cheap, simple competitor to traditional active mutual funds or hedge funds and so on. So it's beaten down fees across the entire investment industry. So hedge fund fees, mutual fund fees, lots of other fees have fallen by around a third over the past 20, 30 years. So I did some very, very rough back of the envelope calculations, but we are talking trillions of dollars saved by savers around the world. That is more money for our retirement, for our kids' college fund, and so on, thanks to the index fund. Even if you haven't invested in them, you've won out from this. But the issue is that they're now so big, there's only really sort of a handful of index fund companies, primarily BlackRock and Vanguard, that, you know, control this entire market. Because the bigger you are, the cheaper you can sell these funds, and the more money goes into those funds, and the bigger the companies become. But at some point, you know, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, another of those big three, as people call them, they control on average almost 25% of the vote in every major US company. And, you know, this is a time when we're all kind of feeling a little bit nervous about, let's say, social media companies and technology companies having so much concentrated power. And the investment industry is far more sort of splintered still. But I think we're right to maybe start thinking at least about whether we feel comfortable with so much corporate power kind of resting through these index funds at these just a handful of investment firms, really.
Yeah, I mean, when you put it that way and you look at only a few firms holding that much power, I mean, it starts to get a little worrisome. You know, we obviously have been through some weird things the last few years globally. Yes. That we just, you know, didn't anticipate, didn't think we would go through. What do you think for my listeners, people who are listening to this episode right now, what are some takeaways about this revolution in creating, you know, creating the index funds, really democratizing investing? Like, are there any great takeaways for people on an individual level for them investing?
Yeah, I mean, so I have to admit, I hate the term democratizing anything because, you know, frankly, I always have connotations to Iraq and we know how democratizing Iraq went, right? But
right.
I do think like investing index funds is the best term for it. Index funds have genuinely democratized investing for a lot of people. And, you know, I'm a financial journalist and I talk to some brilliant people all the time who dedicated their lives to trying to beat the market, and even they struggle. So I will say that the more I learn about finance, the more I realize how little I know. And the only financial advice I ever feel comfortable giving to any friend or family that comes and asks is, you know, index funds. It's just a cheap, easy, fairly conservative way of investing your money, and you can sleep at night. And I like sleeping soundly. So despite me kind of in my book, I do explore some of the downsides, some real, some potential, and some I think are a little bit bogus and offered up by the investment industry as some scaremongering tactics. I still think that even big fans like me should be aware of the potential downsides. I still think that this is, you know, there aren't that many positive inventions that have come out of Wall Street over the past half century, right? And this is unambiguously one of them. I mean, a cheap, simple product in an industry that thrives on complexity and cost, that's pretty wonderful. So I think people should be aware of what goes into an index fund because, frankly, they can all be very different. There's a world of difference between buying, let's say, a Vanguard 500 index fund that, you know, costs you 0.04% and a outrageously complex triple leveraged options based ETF sold to you by a financial advisor who's stuffing his own pockets on the fees from that sale that is quite liable to blow up in your face. I mean, there are many examples I can give of, frankly, stupidly structured index funds that should never be seen the light of day, let alone touch the portfolio of an ordinary investor. But broadly speaking, this is an actual revolution that we can celebrate pretty much unambiguously.
Okay, friend, I want to know, what are your money goals this year? Are you saving to buy a house or maybe a wedding or a dream vacation to somewhere tropical? If that's you, please, please take me with you. Or maybe you want to just grow your emergency fund because, let's be real, life is expensive. I want to make sure you reach your goals, so you need Monarch. That's why the Wall Street Journal named it the best app for growing your savings. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets, track progress towards your financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. Here's what I love. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. You can change the layout of your dashboard. You can go between light and dark mode. You can create custom budgets and notifications. You can set up all of these automatic rules for your transactions and notifications, and so much more. Monarch is obsessed with constantly improving their product. Get this. They release updates every 2 weeks, and they even allow customers to submit suggestions, vote on requested features, and view the product roadmap. This, my friend, is totally original. Plus, they will never sell your data to third party or show you ads. I think that's really important. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it is the top-rated personal finance app. And now, listeners of this show get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/ETM. That's monarchmoney.com/ETM for your extended 30-day free trial. I'm sorry, but I have the best dog ever. Her name is Winnie Stardust. She is a mini golden mountain doodle full of life, and I would do just about anything to keep her happy, healthy, and safe. Today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program.
Your pet is part of your family and you want to do the best for them. But vet bills can really add up. We jokingly keep telling Winnie she needs to get a job to pay for her vet bill. That's why you should check out pet insurance. And with ASPCA Pet Health Insurance, you can focus on the care your pet deserves and cover what matters most. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customized accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping to ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you are least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/etm. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independent American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer, is not engaged in the business of insurance. In those moments when money is just not moving as fast as your dreams, Earnin provides the financial momentum you need to keep moving forward. Earnin is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. You just download the Earnin app and verify your paycheck. Then you access up to $100 a day as you work, and you can leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. I honestly would use Earnin in lots of different ways, but what's on my mind recently is I need a night out. I need some good tacos to sip on a few virgin margaritas and celebrate you all helping this podcast earn 26 million downloads. Make Earnin a part of your financial routine and join Earnin's over 3.5 million customers who say things like, "When I think about Earnin, I think about financial stability and security. Gives me a lot of peace of mind." Download Earnin today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the Earnin app, type in "Talkin' Money" under podcast when you sign up. It will really help the show. Talkin' Money under podcast. Earnin is a financial technology company, not a bank, subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank & Trust, member FDIC. The weather is getting warmer. I'm so excited, and it is time to say goodbye to all those jackets and sweaters, and hello to the shorts and t-shirts. I wanted to update my summer workout wardrobe for the long haul without, you know, spending a fortune. Luckily, I found Quince, and I am in love. Quince is your go-to place from everything from premium European linen dresses, blouses, and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless, 14-karat gold jewelry, and so much more. The best part of all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes those savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. Okay, I bought the dreamiest pair of workout leggings and a bright pink workout top to match. Honestly, ladies, I gotta tell you, these leggings you need. The price cannot be beat, and I feel like $1 million wearing this cozy workout friendly outfit. I've worn it for like 5 days straight. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/etm for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/etm to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/etm. So how do we, I mean, obviously we can't give investment advice, but how do we as the everyday investor then sort our way through these index funds to figure out which ones are solid, are good investments, and which ones are maybe the not so good ones?
Well, exactly how much you invest and what, like you say, we are not, well, I'm not a financial advisor. So, you know, it depends on like how many years you have till retirement and health issues. It's all very idiosyncratic. I have to admit the US tax system, despite living there for 4 years, was a mystery beyond the cosmos for me. I have an easier time with nuclear physics than I do with the US tax code. So stuff like that you need advice for. But fundamentally, you know, investing, as Jack Bogle said, is one of those rare areas of life where you get what you don't pay for. You actually do better by being cheap and lazy. And by being cheap, I mean buying the cheapest funds you can, broadly speaking, almost always do better. Even the cheaper, actively managed traditional mutual funds do better than the expensive ones in the long run. And being lazy by just not overthinking things. Don't go punting money on GameStop or AMC or crypto, but just finding a handful of broad, boring, well-diversified index funds sold by people like Vanguard and putting a bit of money into them every year and then periodically rebalancing towards bonds as you get older. It's the advice that most financial advisors give, or at least good ones, the ones I've spoken to give, that actually, you know, don't try any Hail Mary stuff, right, with your personal savings, because you can get yourself into a pretty deep hole that is hard to dig out of, especially if you're younger. You know, saving a little bit of money in a stock market index fund can make an enormous amount of difference by the time you're kind of in your 60s and 70s, thanks to the magic of compounding returns. But if you choose an expensive fund, well, then you get hit by the nightmare of compounding costs. If you're paying 1% a year to a professional fund manager, that adds up a lot by the time you're 60, 70. And I can guarantee you that statistically, all the data shows that you will do way worse than somebody who just chose a boring, plain vanilla, lazy index fund.
And you make a really good point about, especially the last couple of years, obviously there's been a lot of interest in meme stocks and things that feel potentially a little bit sexier. Obviously, technology has come along and we can now invest very easily from our phones, just a push of a button. Where do you think the future of this goes? I mean, obviously index funds, a lot of them are so cheap, they can't really get any cheaper. Like, where do you think the future kind of goes from here?
Well, I actually think, I mean, first of all, index funds can get cheaper. I mean, most of the boring, simple ones cost, you know, a fraction of a percentage point now. But, you know, there are some people that have started experimenting with free index funds. And it's a bit like some shops will sell you essentially like beer or diapers at cost to get you in through the door and try and sell you on some heavily marked up potato crisps or something. So if you can be disciplined, you can go to some of these places, get a free index fund or nearly free index fund. And I think actually it's all going to be free in 10 years time because it's so simple these days. But yes, the retail trading phenomenon is absolutely astonishing and amazing. And, you know, I have seen one before in my lifetime, the dot-com crisis. I was, you know, a lot younger then. But it seems very familiar. It's very similar to what we've seen many times before in some respects. But like you say, the radical change is free or nearly free trading commissions. You know, even in the 90s, people still had to pay up, you know, $8 per trade. And also you can do it on your mobile phone. You can be on the bus on the way to school and do this. And, you know, back in the day, you had dial-up modem. And for the people who haven't listened
to that. I remember that.
I know, it's awful, right?
Yes.
It's terrible. I mean, just the sound of it still makes me, you know, grind my teeth. Yeah. So I've nailed my flag to the mast. I think this is dangerous. Now, unfortunately, I think, you know, a lot of people have lost a lot of money already. And the data is also unambiguous that eventually ordinary investors are what Wall Street, for a very good reason, called the dumb money. One of the reasons why it's become harder to be a professional money manager in over the past 10, 20, 30 years is because there's less dumb money, as in there are less ordinary people punting the stock market and getting their faces ripped off by the professionals. So I hope this boom dies down and does it soon. Unfortunately, history shows that only happens when we have a massive market setback, right. And people's, you know, lives can be ruined by something like that. And I do think that we're actually in a completely new environment thanks to free trading and gamified apps on mobile phones and Swift dial-up, Swift Wi-Fi. So I think we are probably facing an environment that things will fall back at some point, whether it's next week, next year, or in 5-10 years' time. But it won't fall back to the levels that we've seen in previous lows. There's going to be a higher natural level of retail trading, I think. And also, it's human, right? It's more fun. Nobody goes to a party and brags to people about how they bought a Vanguard 500 fund. That's not cool. You're not the cool person at the party then. You want to talk about how you're an ape on Reddit and you're buying AMC and BlackBerry and GameStop, right? That's way more fun. Even though you probably know in your sort of in your heart that all this talk of sticking it to the hedge funds is complete, bull. Right. It's just more interesting, and you have a sense of community and other people your age are doing it, so it's natural. All I can say is that people should be very careful. And remember that investing is not an extension of our own cultural identity. It's a means to an end, whether it's early retirement, safe retirement, college, a nest egg, a house, or whatever. I see people buy, let's say, Tesla stock or crypto or GameStop because they think it says something about them as a person. And I get that. But, the man doesn't care whether you're buying GameStop. Nobody's made more money out of the trading frenzy in those meme stonks than Wall Street and the trading firms on Wall Street. They love this. Yes, a few hedge funds got their eyes blackened, but they don't care about other hedge funds. They're rivals. They love ordinary investors trading. I worry about how this is going to end because it feels euphoric and frothy at the moment.
Yeah, it's really interesting pointing out that it appears on the outside that you're sticking it to the man or whatever it might be. But we know, if we know enough about finance or Wall Street, people are still making a lot of money, even if it appears through media or social media that maybe that's not happening. It's still happening. And I love you pointing out about just being careful because, I've done 800 episodes of this show and we talk a lot about how money isn't always sexy. It's wealth is achieved in the small things, in the small steps, and the things that maybe seem too foundational, but it's those foundations that really get you to that point.
Exactly. No, it's... Look, I mean, it's natural in that, for example, there's a lot of talk on Wall Street about ESG, environmental governance and social issues, that you avoid investing in oil companies. And I get that kind of a cultural thing, that you don't want to buy stocks in companies that might ruin the world or so on, or tobacco companies or whatever it'll be. But I think treating investing in money as a game or some sort of... wraps up in your identity as who you are as a person, I think, is where I can see things getting out of hand. Nobody minds. Like, I bet money occasionally on soccer results. I follow soccer. My favorite soccer club is Liverpool. It's fun. It's fine. And there's no meaningful difference between me wasting some of my money doing that than somebody doing it on GameStop, really. But I think the trading apps... And the sense that you can get rich quick is such an intoxicating drug. It gets way more addictive than even gambling. So, there have been some high-profile tragedies around this. And, I've seen the studies. I mean, there was a great study on day traders from Brazil the other day that, people might dismiss because, oh, it's just Brazil. But it was a really comprehensive study on how well individual traders did over a long period of time in Brazil. And 97% of them lost all their money, 97%.
Wow.
I think 2.5% made as much money as they'd make working minimum wage in McDonald's. And then 0.5% made more money, as much money or more than they would as a bank teller. So it's just, in the long run, this is, even for professionals, and there's a famous article and book about this is the loser's game. By trading, certainly trading by actively, you're playing the loser's game. Loser's game is a reference to tennis, that, the person that generally wins a tennis match is not the person that does the most brilliant shots. It's the one that screws up the least. And investing is kind of the same thing. You want to minimize your mistakes and then just let the magic of compounding and, generally speaking, financial markets do kind of head upwards in the long run and just make that work for you rather than you work for it.
Yeah, I mean, I put an exclamation on that point. I do have to just sidestep just for a second. So on my, I don't know if it's not a to-do list, but I have to come to a soccer game in Europe. I have recently got into all of the Netflix documentaries about soccer. Obviously, it's not that popular here in the US, but I mean, just to go in the stands of a soccer game, I have to imagine is like one of the craziest experiences.
It is. I mean, even a mediocre game will have a lot of atmosphere, at least at some of the big clubs. But if you're lucky to get a classic match, it's electrifying and it does stay with you for a while. So, you know, if you watched the Sunderland documentary on Netflix, was one of them. Sunderland is a good live audience, I suspect. And, you know, the only problem is slightly out of the off the beaten track if you're flying to London. It's pretty far north and cold.
Sounds like that, but that sounds like the ingredients to a great soccer match.
Yes. You want pies, hot coffee, and very intense football. And that's generally what the north of England offers in abundance.
Tell me a little bit about your career being a journalist, specifically on passive investing. Like, how did you decide this is my sweet spot?
Well, so I ended up in financial journalism purely by chance. You know, like many young aspiring journalists, I dreamt of being a war correspondent. I didn't actually get to be a play actor war correspondent for half a year in Benghazi and Bahrain during the Arab Spring. But my first job out of university was in financial journalism because that's where the jobs were, cynically. And I was always quite curious and I wanted to learn a bit more. And it was like, you know, the Cat Stevens song, the first cut is the deepest. It was just fascinating. Here I was, like a young, sort of early 20-year-old who knew absolutely nothing. And people were paying me to learn stuff and talk to all these interesting people who were, for the most part, but not always, pretty patient about explaining stuff to you. My first interview was doing something Islamic reinsurance, which is as wildly kind of complex and bizarre as it sounds. But I loved it. So I liked figuring stuff out. So financial journalism, despite my sort of dalliance with war correspondenting, was where I've sort of ended up staying. And the reason why I cover passive investing is because a lot of journalism, certainly in politics, I'm sure you've seen that, but also even financial journalism, can be what I maybe unkindly call celebrity journalism. Like every industry has its celebrities. And, you know, what they say makes news. And to a certain extent, they've earned that status. But there can be almost over coverage of certain areas. And for me, you know, whether it's hedge funds or private equity or big banks and Jamie Dimon and people like that, you know, they get really well covered. There's lots of people that cover them all the time. But quite often, the most interesting and certainly the most important stories are the ones that aren't well told because they seem kind of boring. So if you think of the financial crisis, you know, a lot of people kind of saw parts of the puzzle and saw bits and bobs, but they either didn't put it together or, you know, they were too focused on the celebrities, as it were, not the overall shift in the fabric of the financial system that was happening. So I always kind of try to focus on that. Like, I do write about people. People are fascinating. My book is, you know, it's a narrative story about people, the people that did this. But I think fundamentally, I kind of want to use people as a way to explain people the more important, bigger shifts. And the rise of index funds is a classic one that's kind of on the face boring. Like I said, nobody goes into the party and brags that they've invested in a Vanguard 500 fund. But it's one of the most consequential shifts in the entire financial system of the past few decades. And it has so many ripple effects. So I see finance a bit like a jungle, like an ecosystem. But I always say it's a jungle. And the new animals come and go, dinosaurs go extinct, mammals rise up again, and so on. And the index fund is a kind of a tiny little mammal that, you know, was stomped on for a long time and is now this massive, huge beast that is now doing the stomping. And I think, you know, I'm glad it's doing the stomping because I think it's a pretty cool animal and it's made the jungle a better jungle. But I still think people need to understand the impact it's having, and also, frankly, the impact it's going to have increasingly over the next 10 years, because it keeps growing so quickly, right? When I started writing the book, it was 14 trillion. By the time I was done with the research, it was 15 trillion. By the time I was publishing the book, it was 16 trillion. By the time I'm talking to you now, it's 17 trillion. And even that doesn't include all the pension plans and sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf that do this in-house. They don't have like an index fund. They just say, hey, we can do this ourselves in-house. If you add in all that, we're talking at least $25, $26 trillion, like a quarter of the entire financial markets in the entire world, all of it. As a quarter around is just purely passive, following some sort of index. And a change that big is so consequential. I just kind of, I felt it warranted a book, and also warrants one of the reasons why I spend a lot of time in it. But I don't just write about that. I do have other interests I feel I need to stress before I say I'm too one-dimensional.
Yes, I can imagine that one-dimensional, probably you'd wake up one day saying like, I really don't want to talk about passive investing today.
No, the good thing is with finance, it throws up all sorts of fantastic, really fascinating little puzzles for me to figure out all the time. And that's always fun. So passive has been one of the bigger puzzles and one I sort of spend a decent amount of my time on. But, you know, it's just how finance is evolving with technology, right? We almost don't see it as much because we still go to our bank and cash our checks in the US and so on. But, you know, the finance industry is going to just look radically different in 10, 20 years' time.
So what do you think, to sort of summarize here, obviously everyone listening to this podcast, they're reading books, they're hopefully picking up your book, Trillions. They're trying to do the best with their money. What kind of takeaway or wisdom can you share that we could walk away after this conversation, maybe being better prepared for that future that's coming?
Well, be aware of anybody selling you something, and especially if they sell you something that seems too good to be true. I mean, it's kind of the kind of advice our parents used to give us all the time, but it's just, I think it's worth hammering home that, you know, if somebody's selling you something, whether it's an investment fund or a cryptocurrency or something, ask why are they selling this? What do they have to gain? So, you know, use advisors that charge flat fees rather than commissions for how many products they manage to push on you. And just be disciplined. Don't panic when the market drops 50, 60%. I mean, the crazy thing is the stock market, especially, tends to, you know, have pretty good bounce back ability, they call it in football, in English football and soccer. And, you know, if you'd asked us in March 2020, when the world was reeling from COVID, stock markets were, you know, bombed out. And I was genuinely worried we were going to face a financial crisis even greater than what we had in 08 on top of an economic and health crisis. You know, I would have said, oh, God, this is terrible. This is awful. We're all doomed. Stock markets are complete disaster zone for ages. Well, lo and behold, the US stock market has more than doubled since that low in March. So if you'd panicked and pulled your money out, you would have done badly. So that's why I always say investing is one of the rare walks of life, perhaps the only one where it pays to be lazy. But a better word is probably disciplined. Like, being lazy by choosing just a few funds, cheap ones, broad ones, and then sticking to that course. There's a reason why Jack Bogle, who founded Vanguard and built it in this like $8 trillion investment empire, entitled his final book, his autobiography, Stay the Course. I think that's good advice for most people.
Robin, this has been so insightful, such a great conversation. I'd love for you to tell everyone listening where they can go to find you and pick up a copy of Trillions.
Well, it's definitely sold on all sorts of good and bad online retail sales, sites like Amazon and so on, but Barnes & Noble, most good and hopefully some of the bad bookshops and retail outlets will have a copy, I hope. And if not, then I'm way too active on Twitter. It's the crack cocaine of journalism is social media, of course. So, you know, hit me up there. And if you haven't been able to get a copy, then I'll either get Penguin to send you one directly or I'll sort it out, find out how well you can get one.
I sat down and literally read Robin's book, Trillions, without taking a break, all in a Sunday, just ripped through it. I'm a huge documentary lover, and reading this book was like watching a great documentary. It's just amazing to hear about the invention of something like the index fund and how that has really revolutionized the investing world for you and me. It's almost like, why didn't somebody think of this sooner? And then the audacity, I think, to come up with this idea and say, we're going to do this and we're going to change everything. It just blows my mind. I could obviously go on and on about it, but I'll leave you at this. You need to read this book. So as always, if you love this episode, share it with a friend or family member, somebody who you think would be a little bit interested in learning about index funds as well. As always, you can head to the show notes for all the links to our episode guests, as well as our amazing episode sponsors that make this podcast possible. I'll see you right back here in a few days for a brand new episode.
Hey, you. Yes, you. Before you go, we want to say thanks for listening to this episode of Millennial Money. For all the links, tags, and ads you've heard on today's episode, check out the show notes or go to mmoneypodcast.com, where you'll find more episodes to share with your friends. While you're at it, leave us a review and make sure to subscribe wherever you listen so you don't miss out on all the money tips and tricks that will take you from a millennial regular to a millennial money expert. See you back here in a few days with a fresh new episode.